welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Yep, tonight we have another show dealing with metaphysics, spirituality, and, in addition, many different elements of science, some philosophy issues tonight, some ideas that deal with concepts that lead into understanding why certain economies are good and some don't work out so well. So it's spiritual versus material purpose in life. And that's what the show's about. I've done other shows with similar names, but not at all like tonight's show. So it's going to be, don't be misled if you say, oh, I thought I heard something like that before, because this is going to be kind of its own thing. So what do I mean by spiritual versus material purpose, so that we have some understanding of that? A spiritual purpose is a purpose that has a connection to God and the thought of God mind. That's a spiritual purpose. A material purpose is a purpose that excludes the thought of God's purpose as its main purpose, okay, as its main reason for existing. But the interesting thing about this, and I want to be very clear about this part of it, is a spiritual purpose can have within it a material purpose. And a lot of people may not get that right away, even though I'm defining it that way in the beginning, because most people think spiritual is like some kind of thing in itself that is more like, some kind of yoga or some kind of metaphysical kind of search or some kind of esoteric, which means hidden, kind of life, which could be spiritual, but it is by no stretch the definition of spiritual. The same is true of like groups. You've heard me talk about spiritual groups. Well, if you've read, as an example, the textbook I wrote, Life's Hidden Meaning, spiritual groups can be all kinds of groups that most people don't even identify as being spiritual. A group of people doing various scientific endeavors or medical science type of endeavors or any kind of endeavor that is being done in a creative way that follows the thought of our Creator, God. Now, following the thought of God doesn't mean that we are creating what God says. It's the opposite. We are creating new thought that is co-created with our Creator, and only follows in the general context of what spiritual means to God and to those who understand or in some way have some connection to their Creator. Usually understanding is the basis, but though there is the possibility somebody can have a lack of understanding, but still the motive is there to be connected to their Creator in the things that they're doing. So when people are part of a group, as an example, and creating good things, things that they attempt to make good. They may not do it perfectly. They may do it quite imperfectly and sometimes make serious mistakes in it. But their motive is in the right direction. And if their consciousness is, again, even further heightened, both through the experience and in the creation that they're making at the same time, then the process is very spiritual because it's along God's thinking. And this is part of God's plan, is to have humans consciously, that means we are aware of and conscious of, have an understanding of what we're doing, and it's for the purpose of being closer to our Creator. Humans have a need for this because we have an awareness of it. Whereas most species of life below human do not. The kingdoms below human have an absence of that factor, an absence of the awareness, because they can't sense God directly. They can sense parts of God indirectly through us, sometimes if they're our pets, or through the concepts of the virtues of God, such as love, etc. Because animals can love, they just don't understand loving a creator. They can't love God, but they can love other animals. So they step down from where we are, so to speak. when we look at groups doing the same thing, it's the same concept, basically, that you don't have to hate some kind of wildly esoteric kind of group of people that, you know, will sit around all the time, meditate together or something. Actually, those kind of groups, if they are doing that at all, are usually more educational-oriented groups. But sometimes that's, oftentimes, that's not the main emphasis of an educational spiritual group. But regardless, the basic underlying factor is this pursuit of doing goodness, of creating more of the Creator in numerous, countless ways, some of which become material ways, because we're here in the physical world where materiality is what we're trying to deal with in bringing more of God into the material world. So you don't take the materiality out of spiritual, although the spiritual is like the big umbrella and the material is up underneath that umbrella. If you have spiritual versus material purpose in life, as I'm naming tonight's show, then there's an issue of usually conflict. Why is there conflict? Because of illusion. Because human beings are easily in illusion while they're physically alive because their senses don't work very well. They just don't. So since it's a sense of God that gives us some kind of way of, you know, getting it done, so to speak, in terms of being spiritual, if your senses aren't working too good because they're clogged with very dense energies, which we're unable to, what we'll say, not adept at doing, at getting information through very clearly, it becomes illusioned information. Illusion means that it's highly inaccurate, but we don't know it. Yeah, that's what it means. So, I mean, you're not in illusion if you're aware that the information you're getting is grossly inaccurate. That's not illusion. That's just being in ignorance. Ignorance is okay, provided you're aware of it. But when you're unaware of it, then it becomes illusion. And then you got a problem. Because illusion gives us misinformation that could be grossly misinformed. And we think it's correct. And that leads to usually a life of materiality with the exclusion of spirituality in most circumstances. And that's where the problems lie. So we're going to be talking about some of that tonight. And when I talk about purpose, what I'm referring to is purpose can be replaced with the word creative or creation. So it's really about the first part of the two parts of God's thought process. The first part is creation or purpose. There's a lot of other names. We could call it will, or there's just a whole slew of things. But it also has to be joined with consciousness, which is the second part of God's thought, which is understanding, love, and the desire to be giving in ways that helps others to become wise in their giving. So you're giving us to be wise. And it helps them to become better givers in similar ways to still others. Sort of the pay it forward idea. And purpose is the part of life that comes first. But you lose purpose in a spiritual sense if you don't balance it with consciousness. So there is the important definitive difference between material purpose and spiritual purpose. Material purpose almost inevitably reduces consciousness. So the purpose is there still, but the consciousness declines as the purpose is pursued. And that means you're on a material path in life that is usually not going to provide much meaning and may have very bad consequences in some circumstances. If the purpose increases consciousness, then you're on a spiritual path in life. And that's the other definitive way of understanding this. So hopefully that makes some sense to you. I'm trying to make this as simple as possible because these are very conceptual things. But we're going to tonight talk about them in very pragmatic ways, such as how does this affect the present understandings that people have about various ways of earning a living, of having an economy, of sustaining the kind of laws and regulations and rules in society, certain ethics and moral questions, a lot of things like that is what we're going to try to take these very big concepts and apply them in numerous ways so that it becomes a very practical pursuit. So this is what we're going to do tonight. And hopefully this will be the kind of show that people say, gee, I want to go back and hear that one again, because there's going to be a lot of things thrown out there that are practical to your life, hopefully, in the way that you may choose to live or support the lives of other people, of government, of, we'll say, society in general. Because one of the goofinesses of our present world is that there's been a tremendous confusion between spiritual versus material purpose in life. It's so confused that literally it is upside down. And some of you out there may be strongly believing in redistribution of wealth. You've heard those terms of things like socialism, maybe even communism. But if you believe in those things, then tonight's show may be a little earth-shaking for you, because I'm going to show you how those things are virtually incompatible with living a spiritual life, even though on the surface it may be, if you hear it said in the right but wrong way, you can buy into it and believe it's really a good thing. Because after all, isn't it good to give everybody the same of equal amounts, share in equal amounts of the wealth, so to speak, of a society, the material things in society? The answer to that question, though, you'll find as we move through tonight's show, is that it lowers consciousness to do that. And so purpose in life becomes more and more material as you both redistribute wealth and make people feel like they're entitled to get certain things rather than they have the ability, if they choose to individually create. So this becomes a very big thing. So we're also going to be talking about individuality versus collectivism and how is it designed for human beings. And I think maybe let me define that since we're in the definition section. Individual creation is where the creator, us, is co-creating with God, or spirit, if you want to call it that. And we're doing so for the benefit, the initial benefit of our consciousness, which then is used to help others to become more conscious themselves. Okay, so that's individual. What is collective? Well, collective is like going back to the animal kingdom, because they use a collective form of consciousness, because which we call instincts, because they aren't yet capable of thought and awareness combined together. That leads them to their creator, so they have to have a group soul kind of do a lot of thinking for them. And so the result is that by kind of going backwards, what we do is we retard our consciousness to the level of even fairly bright, but not maybe even the smartest of the animal kingdom. But even if it were the smartest of the animal kingdom, they are so much lower in consciousness than humans that it's pitiful. And so when we get to collectivism in terms of the development of human consciousness, it is the anti-consciousness that we're creating. It goes against human consciousness. It creates animal consciousness. Animal consciousness is survival of the fittest. It relies more on some of the evolutionary elements that that have been espoused for the last 150 years or so. It really is Darwinian if nothing else, it leads to societies where, by survival of the fittest, it also means that there is a tremendous amount of emphasis on power and control over one's environment, including others in its environment, so that one has the ability to live better at the cost of others. And you might say, well, wait a second, that isn't what I mean by collectivism. I thought we were redistributing the wealth so we don't live like the animals. Well, the weird thing about it is there is no way to redistribute wealth without lowering consciousness, because consciousness comes through gaining more and more understanding, which comes through creation that is matched to the understanding. When you remove the creation, which is what you do when you give somebody something, or you entitle them to have it for various reasons, the results are that they aren't creating. And so their consciousness isn't going up. It's going down because there's a lack of creation. And as creation goes down, so does consciousness over time, because the person loses the understanding of what their purpose is. The purpose in creation is like that. So ultimately, you have a kind of negative feedback in that system. In the beginning, people oftentimes feel good because it makes them believe that they're making a difference by giving someone something. Give them $1,000, they'll go be able to do something more with their life or whatever. But that doesn't work. Some people say, well, that seems selfish, or maybe we're breeding selfishness. Selfishness is where ultimately you rob a person of their ability to be a human, of their rights to be human. And the right to be human does not come from government. It doesn't come from any other humans, and it doesn't come from any lower kingdom. It only comes from one source, which is God. And so the founders, by and large, of the United States knew that. They knew that. They declared it in our Declaration of Independence. And they knew it because they could see that in the systems where human rights were endowed by monarchs or any kind of government, those people ultimately lost freedom and consciousness. Freedom is another word for purpose, another word for creativity. So ultimately, they realized that those societies became less and less spiritual and more material. And they also realized that in order for a person to be free, they can't be encumbered by being taken care of. It's an encumbrance. It removes your ability to be creative, and it forces you, in some respects, to be under the control and power of some other source. Usually it's government and the people, unfortunately, running it. So that's how it works. It could be something other than government, but I'm just using that because that's a typical way it works. Okay, so hopefully all these highfalutin ideas here are not just swimming over your head, and it's starting to make a little bit of sense. It's kind of like this is, some of this seems counterintuitive, particularly if you're strongly towards the left, and the democratic, as it's used in the present politics in the United States, means of thinking, then this would seem to you, or labor if you're in some other countries, this would seem to you as a, like a foreign idea, maybe antithetical to your belief structure. The problem is that it is seductive and easily misunderstood. So if you're a person who wants to gain a lot of power and control over others, selling them a bill of goods that convinces them that it's really great for everybody to be equal, everybody to have the same whatever or similar, and to remove the differences in material existence between people, to make us all in some way a utopian spiritual oneness. see, you don't become a oneness with others except by developing yourself creatively, individually. That's why God created human beings. Human beings have to become aware of this. Animals don't, because they can never reach a level of awareness or consciousness that would benefit them through this understanding. But humans must, because humans must understand the nature of their Creator's mind, and that the Creator itself decided that it would sacrifice its own levels of both, say, ultimate power and control, and as well as its own levels of everything, because it was at one point everything that existed, so that it could create life that could eventually co-create with it. And the humans are the first part of life that can do this, but at great cost and tremendous struggle in the physical world. Humans have a much better sense of this as they move on in each incarnation to the astral and especially the monastic or mental world. Because in the mental world, it's obvious the things I'm saying are true. In the physical world, it's very hard to come to this realization. If you're young being like in your 20s or early 30s, as an adult, it will be more difficult than if you're older. So older folks gain more wisdom and start seeing some of what I'm saying is true, but younger folks become jaded through illusioned idealism. And the idealism is that they think that a spiritual life is a life in which everybody is the same. And that's absolutely not the concept that God wants for life. But it may be the concept you want to live your life by, and you can do that. So. Now, this is my opinion, of course. If I tell you what God thinks or wants, it's my opinion based both upon experience and meaning and whatever else. But I think the most important thing here is it needs to be espoused in tonight's show, because we're talking about practical outcomes, spiritual versus material purpose in life. And so I've got to go into these things, which does show, obviously, my own opinions without question. And that's always the case. If you listen to the show regularly, of course, I always own what I'm saying as being my opinion. All right, that doesn't mean I'm not influenced. I haven't been influenced by great thinkers, writers, and others. But it means that this is what I've concluded. All right. So, hopefully this has made some sense in terms of the defining aspects. Let's talk about some practical issues, because I want to start earlier than I usually do about practical, since this is mostly going to be about practical. How do we apply this, then, spiritual versus material purpose, if you want to be successful, say, in the material world? Success might mean to you having a lot of money. It might mean that you have a lot of responsibility in terms of various kinds of activities, including vocational. It might mean that you would like to have the ability to decide almost all the different elements of what your life is about. Now, if you require all those things, you're going to need several factors to come true for you. The first is, if you live within society, you're going to need substantial amounts of either money or property or some material form of the ability to eliminate most of the stresses of time and forces of the physical world if you don't have enough material wealth. So wealth becomes a big issue. Now, wealth, in many cases, is unnecessary for people that choose certain routes, we'll say. One of them might be the route of poverty or the route of a preacher or spiritual person involved with some form of an organized or semi-organized religion. In those situations, it is perfectly okay for those folks to choose the non-material, the almost negative material existence. So spiritual doesn't have to include material for them. Most of the other parts of most societies require considerable levels of material. And the more advanced the society is in technology, and the more wealthy the society is in general, the more difficult it is for a person to lead a life that isn't going to require some level of wealth. So then wealth would not be necessarily contrary to leading a spiritual life under those circumstances. Here's where the problem comes in. The material side still has to come after the side dealing with creation and freedom and consciousness. And your material side can never detract from your consciousness, or the results are you're not leading a spiritual life. So here is where the balance comes, and it's tricky. It's very tricky. Because it means that a person has to have a code, we'll say, that we'll call it their ethical moral code, which may not agree with society's, but it needs to be something that's in line to God, that tells them that they are co-creating with their creator, rather than just doing something to increase their material wealth with no other purpose or limited purpose beyond that. And that's where it gets dicey. So what controls it? It's still the individual. I don't want you to think this is something society or government should be controlling. It's exactly the opposite. Because if the individual is not allowed to make those decisions about whether they are creating wealth for the purpose of, you know, having wealth, or they're doing it because it allows them to co-create so much more and help others to do so with their creator. And so they're not affected by the forces of karma, of imagination, etc. They're somewhat protected by it. Then if they are able to do that, that's a great balance. If they aren't able to do that, then they fall victim to it, and their life falls away from the co-creation of God. So what is this code business? What is this business of ethical codes, or some people call it moral codes? Moral is more what society says. Ethical is more what we think. So maybe it's ethical is a better word. But the point is, each decision a person makes needs to be a decision that brings them closer God in some way, rather than more distant. And in terms of wealth, this has to become a factor that's greater in importance than the level of whatever you're trying to gain in wealth. Doesn't exclude wealth as being a purpose of life. It just means that wealth, again, being part of the material, has to be subordinated to the spiritual issue. You could say, well, what are these spiritual codes you're talking about? I'm talking about virtues. And virtue is anything that enlightens rather than creates or removes light, creates darkness or removes light from others. So if what you're doing has an enlightening effect on others, then gaining more material wealth as a subcategory of that is fine. But if what you're doing destroys the light in others. And what is light again? Light again is God's mind. So we're talking about spirit. Now, light or spirit, same thing. We use those words interchangeably. So if you're destroying the spiritual nature of others in the creation of your wealth, then your wealth has become much more important than your spiritual, and you're going in some ways against what would be considered a ethical standard, which may not fit all the mores of a society. I don't want you to think that all the mores established by a particular society are always God-related. Sometimes they are just the opposite, so we have to be careful of that. But nonetheless, the measure is, how much am I improving the spiritual nature of others? by this activity. If I'm improving it, then go after as much wealth as it seems reasonable to have in using it for your spiritual creations. That's fine. If it's detracting from the spiritual nature of others, stop. And find either a new way or a better way of creating wealth, or reduce the amount of wealth that you're going to have, because more wealth is only going to destroy your spiritual life. So. Now, why is it that some people, it's better that they not have a lot of wealth? Well, some people want to pay extreme attention to helping others to become more spiritual. And for that reason, they may renounce wealth. They may belong to a specific religion in doing so, or they may have a very spiritual purpose in their life for doing so. Whatever it might be, the point is that they do it for that specific purpose. They are an extreme example of helping others to become more spiritual, usually somewhat at the cost of something such as material wealth and sometimes other issues as well in their life that may sacrifice for the benefit of others. That's a specific kind of spiritual life. Most people don't live that kind of life, and so it would not be germane to them to do that. But the few people who do, and it's very important to them, and then for those reasons that may renounce most or all of their wealth for whatever purposes they need to achieve certain spiritual goals. Okay. What other pragmatic issues come into play then in this question of wealth? Well, wealth really is the ability to collect a lot of energy and time that you can use in the future. It has another name for wealth can be money, except that money has to have with it an associated wealth factor. Some money becomes worthless because of inflationary issues and misguidance on the part of the people usually who are manufacturing the money, which is the government, and they remove the wealth from it. But let's assume that that's not the problem in the immediate case. And so money and wealth could be substituted for each other. So it's compressed time and energy. Now, for some people, they might say, well, but I also like having very fancy this or that in my wealth picture. And it isn't just a bunch of reasons for having compressed time and energy. It's because I like nice things. But most people, if they really examine it carefully, find that they, if they're doing it in a spiritual sense, they like nice things because of certain increases in comfort that reduces stress on them, which allows them to be more efficient in terms of their other uses of time and energy. Unless someone is, quote-unquote, collecting wealth for the purpose of having it to show to others or for their own amusement or whatever, and in those cases, they're probably got the dilemma that I talked about a few minutes ago, where they are caught in the wealth for its own sake, and they are losing sight of the enlightenment issue in others. It doesn't enlighten others for people to hoard wealth and to have it for its own sake, and especially to show it off to others. It doesn't help others. So the result becomes one of what you would say, what the underlying motive and rationale is about what one is doing with the wealth. So most of the time, the bottom line of wealth is this thing of preserving the ability to be able to function as spiritually as possible within a world of extreme forces where the physical world is. You go on to the astral world, the most important commodity in the astral world is sense itself, sense and creative imagination. If you've got those, you can create almost anything else that you want, but not so here in the physical world. Those are the differences, which are pretty remarkable differences when you consider them. Okay, and to finish up with the idea of wealth, some people prefer to believe that wealth is something that you have as a security interest for some issues in your future. Security is usually about things like, and it could be your security or security of others. You can give it to family members and you think that you're helping them in some way. But most of the time, wealth in that respect is fear of death in some hidden form. And what it really involves is the sense of, and if it's all about that, the sense of fear of the future, so to speak. Now, does that mean you shouldn't have food and other things stored away? What if there's an atomic war, a nuclear war? What if there's this or that? That's a totally different issue if you're trying to preserve your life to be of service than if you're trying to preserve your life, period. Okay. So the preservation of one's life without purpose is the misnomer of security wealth that you either give to family or friends or that you retain for yourself. That kind of wealth is an anchor around you. Interestingly, it will shorten your life and reduce your number of things you can create. So it's kind of a goofy upside-down thing, and our society almost is sickened with its prevalence. People are continuously willing to their heirs amounts of wealth that has always going to destroy their heirs' life in some respect because it's similar to the entitlement problem. And it also detracts from your own creativity. They should be using that wealth in a much more meaningful way. So you look at these things and you say to yourself, wow, we've got a lot of screwed up reasons for doing things that don't make any sense. So that completion of that concept of wealth is, I think, enough for us right now. So when we come back and we talk about many other practical consequences, a spiritual versus material purpose in life, and we will do that in about 2.5 minutes, give or take, from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower, MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about spiritual versus material purpose in life. Now, I've done shows on this named subject before, but never from the perspective that I'm talking about tonight. So this is going to be kind of new information, even if you listen to every show I've done before. And so this will probably be very practical, I hope. We finished with the idea about willing money to people and or things, as well as possibly trying to live off of collected monies that a person may have, more or less in retirement. Let me explain why these are impractical and potentially destructive to both you as a giver, so to speak, and those of receiver, if you're talking about a will. The problem here is that when we give things to people, we're practicing the negative side of spiritual versus material purpose in life. We're really giving them material things, and we're not helping them become more spiritual. The issue is basically that when people receive things, if they aren't working to create, and if they aren't using those things in very creative ways, and gaining consciousness in the process, then the things become negative to them. They lose consciousness, and they oftentimes squander, will squander the money. If they don't squander it because they lost consciousness, they will become even more potentially selfish and lacking virtue in terms of their life. Remember what I said earlier in the show, this is a question of having the proper code, the proper virtue, virtues to be able to function, and you don't gain those things by giving them. Let's take it to another step, going in a different direction. People do this later in life with their quote-unquote grown children oftentimes, but a better thing to look at is, what about raising children? This is a big subject for me, a big deal. I don't believe much in giving children things. I believe that it's best to supply certain raw materials, so to speak, for children to become creative, and at the same time, creative in ways in which they're helping others to become more enlightened, more spiritual, so that their creations themselves take on a spiritual meaning. That is the best thing you can do in terms of giving children anything. Part of the giving, therefore, is spiritual education, and it also includes the proper use of materiality. Proper use of materiality is that a person has to earn the material that they are being creative with by being creative in ways that are enlightening to others. And so every step of the way, there's a, so to speak, increase in what's given while the person is being co-creative with God. That is the best way to raise children. Now, I kind of did that very fast. Let me give you some examples so it might make a little more sense. Let's say you've got, like, an 8-year-old. 8-year-olds are pretty cool, right? I'm not going to go back, by the way, to 2 or 3, because this model doesn't work until after age 5. But let's say you have an 8-year-old. 8-year-olds have become aware of material world to a fairly large degree. That's the reason I picked 8. 7 and lower, they have some missing elements, and that's special cases. Those are special cases, and those I can talk about later, but right now, take an 8-year-old. If you want your 8-year-old to start becoming a really spiritual being, so to speak, then make it so that everything, and I don't care if it's clothes or food or toys, as people call them, or any kind of hobby, or anything. Make it so that that is something they can co-create in the use of and in the having of. And you can say, well, how can you co-create clothes? Well, one way would be to help them to want to become aware of how they want to appear to other people, and why they would want that in terms of affecting or enlightening those other people's perceptions about So how one dresses has an effect on how other people see them and how other people will relate with them and how they can influence other people's virtue and spiritual ways of dealing with things. That's a big awareness, and you can start that around 8 years old. That's a really cool thing to start developing in a child at such a young age. Now, the sort of things you will avoid if that's done is that affectation will not become a major part of that child's life in most likelihood. What does that mean? All things like we consider these days normal, I guess, things like tattoos and various ways of puncturing our bodies and wearing whatever. Those kinds of things are really ways of getting noticed. That's what they're called, affectations. They have an emotional effect on others so that they will notice the person that is doing it. Why is it bad? Because it brings attention to the person for selfish reasons that is using it, rather than enlightening other people about the real nature of that person, which are trying to hide, by the way, through the affectation. The real nature of the person may be that they feel inadequate, that they are missing certain standards of wanting to help others to, in some way, become co-creative themselves, and that they don't want to co-create together with other people and God at the same time. There's an exclusionary issue to the use of all affectation behaviors. So the interesting part of this is that if you start at 8 years old and you're working with such young children and they're learning to dress in ways based upon their own decisions that has positive effects on others, then their chances of developing any disorders in their personality later, especially during their teenage years, is much less. And they will recognize that problem in others who have it very early and will react in ways that are more appropriate to helping those people become more spiritual, because that's what they'll have a greater consciousness than the other folks do. It's a wonderful idea, actually. It's a very small thing I'm talking about right now, but it has real meaning, practical meaning in the world as it is today. Now, you could say, well, what's it really better hundreds of years ago where people didn't use as much affectation, but they were so rigidly controlled, they all wore little, triangular-shaped hats, maybe, if you go back to the 18th century and before. But that is another issue. Instead of conformity, it's another factor that you're eliminating when you make a creative effort that is co-creative with virtue or creating God at 8 years old. So you're not teaching conformity, you're doing the reverse. You're teaching non-conformity in a sense, but non-conformity that is virtuous in the spiritual development of that person and the people that that person is going to have, or a child, I should say, is going to have interactions with. It's really a great thing. I'll use another example. I used food. What about food? Well, these days, food is a real problem because we have a tendency to be non-conscious about the nutritional value of food. It isn't so much this business about people eating out so often at fast food places that's the problem. It's that nobody has consciousness about the lacking of nutrition in some types of fast food. That's the real problem, isn't it? The same thing is true about school lunches and the whole other thing. So at 8 years old or so, it'd be good to start, and this you can start earlier, by the way, because food is a more basic thing than clothing. You could probably start this at 5 pretty easily. That you start, the child starts learning the nutritional value of all the foods that he or she likes and doesn't like, and what the advantages and disadvantages are to those kinds of foods. And then the child starts making note of what kind of nutritional elements as a record that they're consuming. And how does that affect their friends? And when they go places with their friends, they say, gee, I'd rather have that than this. And their friends will say, why? What's wrong with what I'm eating? Well, because it has this nutrient or lacks that nutrient, it has this. And they start creating virtue through consciousness, by raising the consciousness of others. They aren't demanding that anybody else follow their food regimen, of course. They aren't conforming necessarily to other people that are eating or drinking certain things. But they become much more conscious. Now, what does this mean later in life? Well, first of all, especially as they enter their teenage years, during growth spurts, they're going to be far more nutritionally, fat. They're going to be, therefore, their brains will work better, their minds will work better. Their behaviors will be less affected by some adverse types of foods. And at the same time, they're going to be so understanding how basic it is to take care of themselves, that at this very basic level, that they're going to be much more self-reliant. Now, you don't think of food and what you eat as a measure of how self-reliant somebody is. But for an eight-year-old, even a five-year-old and up, to be starting to develop these kinds of thought processes, it is self-reliance. And for a teenager, particularly, to observe some of it, at least some of the time, is a big deal. Because teenagers don't have self-reliance, they have conformity. Now, why is that? Because they have oftentimes senses of inadequacy about their levels of consciousness. Not their levels of knowledge, but their levels of consciousness. And so they go for a group kind of consciousness that makes them feel more secure, but at a great cost. Because like in today's world, that group consciousness is leading to 20-30% overweight problems, to very poor nutritional means of eating, and at the same time to economically wasteful means of eating, because they purchase things that are usually quite expensive but of poor nutrition. So you end up with a kind of double whammy, so to speak, in that situation. And this is done because, or more often than not in teenagers, it's done because of the fear of being excluded from the group, so to speak, because they don't have a good sense of self. Their self-identity is low. And that comes from the fact that they didn't learn self-reliance about food and clothing and many other things at a much earlier age. So you avoid most of the pitfalls of adolescence and all the problems that people complain about having an adolescent when 5 or 10 years earlier you brought the children up the way I'm suggesting. Now, you might say, well, why do you have to tell us how to raise a kid? I'm only using concepts here, somewhat of psychology. But a lot of this has to do, again, with the spiritual versus material purpose in life. And it starts at a very early age. If you're going to really get to the concepts of what I'm saying, these applications are right there. They're right at the basis of what I'm talking about. And they certainly have a lot of value as far as I'm concerned. Okay. So what are some of the other elements that come into play in terms of, we'll say, the idea of wealth in children? Well, most of the time, children become fixated on having certain things in our present society, being like the United States or a country similar to the United States. It isn't true all over the world, but it is in places where there is substantial amounts of wealth. And the problem here is that the child identifies the material thing with, in some way, their esteem of themselves, the love of their parents, and what they think of other children. So that's a very, very bad consequence. What do you want to do with that? Well, most of the time, the object should be that wealth is used to create more virtue and helping others to become enlightened. And if you provide that as a concept, then everything that the child is learning to desire, so to speak, in wealth, is a desire to use the wealth in some creative way to be beneficial towards others. That doesn't mean they're becoming, quote-unquote, little communists, where they're all going to work and have the same things. No, just the opposite. I'm saying they can have very unique things, but as long as they're co-creating and using those unique things to be helpful in a spiritual sense in your life. It doesn't have to be only spiritual. They can still enjoy the things they have. But they enjoy them in a creative sense, and it's something that helps to enlighten the people. And it is never used as a means of showing off or making others think that there's something better because they have something material. There's nothing more obnoxious than that, and that really produces a terrible type of personality problem that later on can be very obnoxious and hard to change. So you don't want to go in that direction. Hopefully this sort of makes some sense about the Melissa in terms of children. I like talking about kids because I think that if we could just change one generation of children, we'd be in a lot better shape, right? But it starts with the adults, right? Even if adults aren't living right, if they really work at helping their children live right, maybe with the next generation will be better. But, of course, it's pretty hard to do that because the adults have to have enough consciousness to know that they aren't living their life right in the first place in order to make some changes. And it's not that easy to do because children learn what they live more than what they're taught. So if you can't change their own life, it's going to be pretty hard to get your kids to be much different. That's one of the problems. Okay, let's take a little breather. I just wanted to mention something to you, and that is you may know about Fei Chi Jizik, which it's been out for a few months now. And if you haven't tried it, this is a great time to do so. And if you want to buy some more, another great time to do so, because it's on sale, at least for the next number of months. It is. I don't know how long. And if you buy the large bottle, 100 count, you can get that retail for $30 a bottle. Now, we're making sure that the stores that are selling it will be offering it at that. But if you buy it directly from the website or anyway from the manufacturer, you'll be still able to get that $30 price, which is good. The travel size bottle, which is has been $19.95, by the way, is now $12 a bottle. By the way, the $30 bottle used to cost $49.95, so that's a big change. It's $20 off. So these are really good prices. I hope you'll consider it. You can get some at buyjizik.com. Buyjizik.com. You can also call this phone number, 602-431-5762. 602-431-5762. And get some for, it's a New Year's sale, I guess they call it that. But get some right away because I don't know how long this is going to last for, but the point is that if you've been kind of hesitant, because it's not a cheap product, it costs a lot of money to make it, it's more than just about anything else out there, then this is a good time to try to get, buy as much as you want and use it, because it lasts for years. So as long as you keep it in a reasonable environment, it lasts for years. And so you're going to be able to use this stuff, and it's just terrific on any kind, or most kinds, I should say, of pain. And a lot of people find it extremely helpful to use. And it has benefits beyond just that, but I'm not supposed to talk about this. FDA wouldn't like it. But I think that, in a personal sense, I think it really is helpful in dealing with all kinds of chronic things that people have in terms of pain. So try it out, see what you think about it. And it's guaranteed. Doesn't work, get your money back. That's just the way it is. Yeah. No kidding, that's the way it is. Even if you use it, you say, I used a whole bottle, so how am I going to get money? You can still get your money back. It's all right. But you can only do it once. So, you say, I keep buying bottles to get my money back. Now, you can't do it that way. But you get your money back on one bottle if you didn't find it work for you. Okay, so let's get back to the subject because this is a fascinating subject to me anyway. All right, so besides, I'll skip around here, besides just the question of children, which I have just a whole show on kids and things we could talk about, practical things you can do with kids. I know some of you don't have kids, and I don't want to just talk about kids for the sake of talking about kids if you don't have kids, but let's talk about it, and some of these things you could apply back to kids anyway, so we can still think about it in that terminology. What are some of the other pragmatic issues when we're talking about, how to live spiritually versus materially, your purpose in life? Well, for most people, meaning is a big issue. Now, I say this with the aren't aware that their problem is meaning in life. Now, why is that the case? It would make much sense, right? Why wouldn't we be aware that our life doesn't have much meaning and we are miserable because of it, but we don't aren't aware of it? Well, here's the point, and I'll try to make it as clear as possible. Meaning comes from developing higher consciousness, but the ability to be aware of something drops faster than the consciousness. Okay. You got that? Okay, you got that concept? So your awareness in general drops faster than your consciousness in most circumstances. So because of that, people are oftentimes unaware of some of the most basic things that you think would think they could not be unaware of, like, is their life meaningful? And that's the problem, because they, in order to evaluate that, they have to have consciousness, which is lost. In order to have more meaning, they have to have consciousness and gain it. And in order to be aware of it, they have to maintain a level of consciousness that usually would provide more meaning than lacking it. And so the people who lack meaning oftentimes are unaware. And that's a big problem. Okay. So how can you make yourself more aware? Where can you bring this in so that you can do something about it? Well, the first thing is a small amount of spiritual discipline can go a long way in evaluating this question. The first thing I would suggest is attempt to become more conscious in a very narrow range of your life, a little bit at a time, by increasing that level of givingness in your love, so that you are a more loving person a little bit more each day. If you do that within a few days to a week, you'll be able to increase your level of awareness of meaning. And you will also notice that possibly the meaning is slightly elevated anyway, just from increasing the consciousness by a small amount. And then that will be like a big signal, like maybe you don't have enough meaning in life. How is that going to then change? What are you going to do? Well, the first thing is to be, we'll say, consistent, because meaningful lives have some level of consistency in the creation or purpose side of things. And most people have a high level of inconsistency. They may have a lot of quote-unquote will to do something on a short-term basis, but their lack of consistency in the exercise of that will leads them astray, and so their life becomes kind of meaningless. The other thing that's real important to realize is that meaning is really mostly related to the amount that we create of, again, light in ourselves and in the world. It's very difficult to have a meaningful life if you're a fairly developed human being, meaning in terms of probably number of lifetimes. Most people actually have lived quite a few lifetimes, and so they have a need for a more intense, meaningful life than, let's say, a much younger soul with less incarnations might have, and at an earlier time in history, probably. So meaning is a contextual factor about what a person sees as their life's purpose. And that purpose, if it's spiritual, more spiritual than material, the life will have usually a significant amount of meaning. If not, meaning will be lacking. What happens when meaning is lacking in life? Well, then you end up with some really harsh circumstances. First of all, with a lack of meaning, a person becomes lonely. And you say, well, where's the relationship between meaning and loneliness? Loneliness is not being around people or whatever. No, it doesn't mean that at all. Actually, technically, a person could not be lonely and their relationship strictly be with God. So and their soul. But in most circumstances, it does mean something about other people. And meaning that is, let's say, more hidden from people, and is the part that is comes out more in the more developed person. Not a person who's necessarily leading a purely spiritual life, but maybe has had hundreds of reincarnations. To that person, meaning is oftentimes a life that in some way provides some level of service to others. That level of service has its own unique qualities to it because it's based upon how the person chooses to be creative in their life again. And that means that when a person is lacking meaning, they're not being of service to other people. And when you're not being of service to other people, you feel lonely. Even if you're around people all the time, Let's say you're virtually swamped with people. If you're not being of service, you will have a strong sense of loneliness. Now you could say, why is it that you're getting, why is it you feel unlonely? And you're spiritually of service in some way or to others, is because you're connecting not to them as a person, but to them as a soul. Your soul is coming through you and connecting to them, and that's what the service is about. And so it's service that leads us to our soul, which makes us feel less lonely, and that also connects to the other person's soul, which many times magnifies or lessens the amount of loneliness. So serving as a soul makes you feel less lonely in general, and then you feel much closer to others because the closeness comes from relating to them as a soul rather than as a person. You cannot get very close to another person. You can only get close to a soul. Why is that? Well, when you try to get close to a person, the personality is mostly concerned with material issues and with control and power, whereas the soul is mostly concerned with co-creation with God, consciousness, love, and co-serving together. One leads to a meaningful life that rids you of loneliness, and the other leads to a very lonely life that rids you of meaning. I said a lot there. I'm kind of going a little bit faster than that. So in a practical way, let's say that you really understand yourself enough. I mean, you may have to do some of these exercises about becoming a little bit more loving each day to try and even understand how much you are lonely and how much your life is meaningless. But let's say you've got that down. You say, yeah, you know, Niles, you're right. I'm lonely. And I have a meaningless life or less meaning than I want. And the two actually are going hand in hand, then you're not relating to other people as a soul. That's your big deal. And you're not. And remember that if you're serving others and they are, part of your service has to be helping them to become more of a soul. Remember, that's the definition of it. So if you're not doing that, then you're not really serving them. You may be giving to them in unwise ways, but not serving them. And that will make you feel more lonely and make them feel more lonely, and it will also reduce both of your meanings in life. Whereas the reverse is true if you're functioning as a soul and you're helping them to do the same. Then you're building up this whole system, and loneliness just goes completely away. The most lonely people are the people who are not functioning as souls. They couldn't be any lonelier because there's no way to get close to the personality in someone else through your own personality. Because personalities, by definition, are separative and selfish and are seeking control of others rather than sharing. And so the results are disastrous. Now, you say, well, what about people who are selfish? How are their lives coming out? Well, not too good. Because, again, then they're leading their life for a material purpose rather than a spiritual one. And the results are oftentimes terrible. Now, will they always admit to this loneliness and this lack of meaning? Not too often. You should try to hide it from themselves as well as others. And so it's a difficult process for them to open up and find that. But you can help people like that if you yourself at least are leading a more spiritual life, even if they won't participate in it, by how unaware people are of these issues. And it makes their life very miserable, extremely so. It's one of the basic foundations of being alive. And it's one of the reasons that human beings get much joy out of life at all. Because we lead in generally an unjoyful life because of the difficulties, especially in the physical world. So it's a difficult place to have joy. So if you lead your life as a soul, you have this meaning and the connection with others that dissolves the loneliness, and you have a true love between you, which is a great thing. All right, let's move on to the next big issue in terms of practical side of life. These are the biggies I'm trying to cover first. We can get in more detail if we have the time. Many people find that they, at least they think, their life is, in terms of time, lacking sufficient time to live your life in both a purposeful way and even in a way which might be spiritual. I don't have enough time for that. Okay, let's talk about the time model and what the problem is there. When people are focused in the material side of life, they destroy most of their time through grand amounts of mistakes. Most of their mistakes, to them, are, I just forgot this, or I just did that wrong, or I didn't pay attention enough to here or there. Or, in some cases, they involve themselves with others who are also doing the same thing, and so they are compounding their own mistakes by all the mistakes of the other people that they're doing this, because that's what happens. And so their whole life is compounded by the mistakes of so many people that they have no time at all. Why is a mistake a waste of time? Well, the definition of time is separating the quality of space from consciousness. And so ultimately, you'll end up with this time being wasted time, because it takes no time to do things in a perfect situation where you're completely enlightened and only creating more light. It doesn't take any time to do anything in that respect. But we know that it takes a lot of time for us to do things in the physical world because we make so many mistakes, which are really selfish focuses on ourselves, and that do not enlighten anyone or do very little. And that in the long run, create forces rather than effortlessness in our interactions. So our interactions, instead of being mostly effortless, are very forceful, tremendous amounts of energy, tremendous amounts of additional destruction of our self, our physical and other body cells. And so the results are that we are using up form, which is energy, rather than conserving it. And we, at the same time, wasting time. So what I say is you're manifesting energy and you're wasting time. The wasting of time comes first before the manifestation of energy, but most people don't see it that way, so it doesn't matter how you choose to see it. Wasting time is always that. Most people could do the same things they do each day in one-third the time, with only a minimal amount of improvement in their spiritual life and their consciousness. I'm saying minimal. Doesn't even have to be huge. You can increase, and you get a threefold increase. That sounds incredible. So I'd like you to consider this as a practical thing to try if you want more time. But more time means that your focus cannot be on yourself. Focus has to be on co-creation with God, being spiritual, and reversing any material aspects as being primary in your life. If you do that, you're going to have much, much more time to do things within, and you'll make far fewer mistakes. And I'm talking about the simplest of mistakes, from, I left my keys here or there, to the most complex of mistakes. Didn't show up for work for the last week, and that might be a big mistake. So the thing is that if you choose these things in your life, you can make relatively to make a big difference. If you're screwing up very little, it may take a lot to make a much more improvement over that, but then you've already reached the point where it's relative and you can spiritually discipline yourself so much that it doesn't take any more effort to do it. It's just that you're more able to. Okay, so why is it that people then continue in this model of feeling crunched with time all the time? It's because they live in the illusion of the moment. They believe that others are removing the time from them, be it through things or institutions or whatever. Their model is that these things out there are reducing their time, when it's all an internal reality that's really controlling them, and they kind of, in illusion, project it out to the rest of the world and think the rest of the world is causing them not to have this time. But it isn't true, not at all. Also, as you get better at this time model, you improve so much your abilities and competency that you become more able to handle greater responsibilities. And the weird thing about this is, listen carefully, the higher the level of responsibility that a person can successfully do that causes enlightenment in themselves and others, the less amount of time it takes for them to do anything. So when people say, well, gee, I got a very responsible job, and it's just taking me so much time. No, it's just the opposite. They are not living up to their abilities or responsibilities, because if they were, their job would take much less time. And the more responsible the job is, the less time it should take to do. Okay, I know that sounds counterintuitive. Some of you are probably saying, oh, that guy's crazy. No, I'm not. I'm not crazy. It's just that when you have a more responsible job, it means you're more creative, and you can create so much faster and so much better. Job will go much faster, whatever it is, being very general about this, than if you're doing a completely, you know, like on a assembly line all day doing the same thing all the time. You know, it's a non-creative job. Lacks responsibility, obviously. Maybe you're responsible for making sure you don't break something or don't misalign something, whatever, but it's very new. And that job is a tremendous waste of your time. So, jobs that are highly responsible and creative and create more light at the same time are not really jobs at all. They are ventures, you might say. Even if you're working for someone else, that would be true. Who you work for is not so important as how you work. And so that's the critical element. You can have a relatively low job if you can find ways of being creative in it that you're permitted to do. And if that's the case, then keep the job. Otherwise, find a different job. The point is that the ultimate goal here is to have much more time, and you can if you live your life in that way. That doesn't mean you can keep every job that you might have right now, because some jobs may not permit that to happen. Then it's your choice to leave that job and do something else, create your own business, do whatever you want to do. The point is that you need to do it in a way that is highly creative and creates more light at the same time. Helps others to do the same. So let's talk about that. Let's move into that element. Let's talk about vocation now. Talk about the time element. That's one part of vocation. But generally, people get very confused about vocation being an important part of life. Most people are driven in vocation by their personality. We already know that has a big problem. So why do you want to not be personality-driven in your vocation? Well, because it's about material wealth gain, how much money you're making, how hard you're working, quote-unquote, and whether or not you have a lot of esteem, a lot of people think you're great, all that kind of stuff. Those are personality factors, and maybe how much you control others, depending upon the nature of your job, if you're in that role. But the most important part of vocation is to make it non-vocational. So you don't want a vocation. What you want is more of both an avocation that is spiritual that earns significant amounts of what you're looking for. If it's, in this case, wealth, gaining through also doing something spiritual, then you have a totally different criteria in which you decide on doing learn is for spiritual purposes, that makes it easy. But very, very few people live their life that way. Most people do not use most of the income that they earn for spiritual purposes. Maybe a few percent might go for that in the average situation. If it's way more than that, you're lucky, because then you have the opportunity to work for non-personal reasons, but for really spiritual reasons. The more you can move in that direction, be it a self-employed situation or a employed by others situation, the more you're moving from vocation to avocation of virtue rather than avocation of a hobby or so. If you advocate virtue in your employment, then that job is not really a job or work anymore. It becomes a part of your service in general. That's the ideal way to look at employment and jobs. How you do that is really up to you and what scope you're finding yourself, etc. But it's very important to recognize the difference between personal interests in vocation, which is the majority. It's almost 99.9% of the people are in vocations based on personal interests. And making it spiritual changes the whole ballgame. Everything turns upside down, inside out, and it's no longer a job. It's, as I said, a spiritual application of some sort that maybe you don't have to tell people about, but it's the reason you really are about. And these kinds of things makes your life very spiritual, and it ensures virtually the material side, because obviously you can't be very material if most of the things you're doing vocationally or avocationally in the spiritual sense are using the material things that you are getting through a job or through a vocation for spiritual life. And that's like the perfect situation. You don't have to worry about what we're talking about tonight. So you're going to be living that in that respect. It's just that most people don't. And so unfortunately, as our world is designed today, it's an anti-spiritual world because the societies, particularly the wealthier societies, promote a personal interest in work over a spiritual one. Now, can we change that? I mean, could the whole society change? Sure. I don't see it happening anytime in the near future, but it could. Can you change it? Yes. Each of us has an individual ability to change, which is the wonderful thing about spirituality in general, is it is individual, not collective. In order to change it on a collective basis, you have to get everybody individually, virtually enlightened in the first place. And then the collectivism isn't really collectivism, it's just everybody's working for a spiritual goal, and then you have like a spiritual society. That's what many people who are idealists and who are seeking, quote unquote, a collectivist society, such as a society that is more socialistic or whatever, that is what they believe in. But unfortunately, the outcome is the opposite. You see? And so this is, it's like, well, gee, in a perfect world, this would be great. But the world isn't perfect. The world's not only not perfect, it's extremely imperfect. People are very imperfect. And so we have a lot of bad problems as a result. Okay. Now, how then to travel in ways that you are outside of your personality most of the time, not just in locational issues? Well, the personality is the subconscious. So the more you become conscious in general, the more the personality is removed from the equation in terms of most of the decisions, most of the interactions you have with others in your life. So another way to look at this is the subconscious and unconscious parts of us are what most people are controlled by. And the conscious side, if we expand it, then balances and eventually overcomes the personality. Personality is also very young and doesn't grow up very much. It's really an immature part of all of us. And the best thing to do with personality is to have it fuse with your soul. And then you become soul-like, and the personality no longer has its detrimental aspects to it. It's actually been brought into a state of consciousness. You sort of grow it up. Can you do that through a purposeful life? Yes. That is spiritual? Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the personality really is looking for meaning in life. It's just afraid that the answer is that it should stop existing. It doesn't know that it can join with the soul and become immortal, whereas if it doesn't join with the soul, it will at some point cease to exist. So the very thing that it's afraid of is what it's creating for itself out of fear. That is a wacko. Huh? So you can kind of get the personality to go along with it if you can convince yourself, conscious part of you, that leading a more spiritual life leads to immortality. And leading a less spiritual life that is more material leads to death. So you're going from death to immortality by taking your personality and having it become connected, directly connected on a conscious level with the soul. Personality has to permit it to happen. It's a big control freak. And in most people, it will sabotage that in so many different ways. We see this all the time, me being a group of people that I co-serve with in spiritual ways. And it's so often that it happens that it's scary. The personality is a fortunate, needed instrument because for a good part of a human being's life, before they're about 28 years old, it's needed just to keep us alive, especially before we're 21, that's true. And without it, we would succumb to too many pressures and accidents and other issues. So it's sort of like the controlling agent keeping us from walking off a cliff and hurting ourselves. And from entering into relationships that may be severely detrimental to us as well. Personality does have some good things because it's needed for those things, especially when we're very young. But as we grow, and especially if our parents help us to become more spiritual early in life, then the personality can start joining with the soul and say, hey, this isn't so bad. Hey, you know what? I'm going to live forever if I keep doing this. And that's what its whole big problem is, it's afraid of death. So once it says it's going to live forever by becoming part of the soul, it's on board, you see? But that's usually something you need to start at a very early age if you're going to have it happen at a reasonable age for a person to be able to use it effectively in their life. It's very important to raise children spiritually for that reason alone. Big deal. It's also important to raise everything that way, even animals. Find better if you do that if they're pets, because they develop a little bit of self and they have some personality, which they're getting from you. So you can help them as well. And that may help them to individualize, meaning they get an individual soul earlier than the rest of their species. So it's a big deal. It's a huge accomplishment to do. Sort of like becoming a master, you might say, or something like that in terms of an animal. Cool thing. Okay, so let's talk about some of the other things that are practical about spiritual versus material purpose in life. One of the things that I think that people oftentimes don't realize is important is a philosophy that fits in with God's philosophy. One of the things I've been recently intrigued with, I saw the movie Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. The first part, the three-part movie, if it ever gets made, I don't think it will, unfortunately. But years ago, I was supposedly going to read that book, and kind of didn't and did. But now I'm looking at it again. Excellent ideas. Ayn Rand is really a very metaphysical and spiritual woman who, at the same time, touted herself as a philosopher because she didn't think that the metaphysical and spiritual parts of what she believed in would sell very well. She definitely believed in the free marketplace. And so she presented herself more to the public as a philosopher and an author. And Atlas Shrugged is a great book. I recommend it. It's huge. But it's a great book or movie, if you can see the first part, you can rent it, that talks about how the philosophy of people is a major part of how they see and interrelate with their society and government. And but I don't want to ruin the book for you, but I just want to tell you in general, when people have philosophies that they believe in the rights of the individual, that that you can't take things away from people, if your philosophy of living is that each person has unalienable rights given by the Creator, and that each person is, without question, a unique and special being, and that has tremendous creative abilities, if allowed to be creative, and that most people are too afraid to be a creative because they're either brought up incorrectly, or society itself has structural problems around them, above, or they're young souls. And in any case, whatever the situation is, most people are still part of the, we'll call them the masses, where they haven't yet exercised their full creativity. A philosophy of trying to help people to do that without having to just give them things, by helping them to help themselves, and by helping them to be more creative, and by being a good example of being a creator and not giving, and by not letting government take and destroy and entitlement through entitlement and other issues, and by recognizing the evils of socialism are really serfdom to most people, for most people, and particularly destructive to the creators, by the way. If we do those things, then we're living a philosophy, not too different from Ayn Rand's philosophy, by the way, that believes in free markets, believes in the process of living a life in which you are the representative to others of creation itself and co-creation with God, and living a life that is spiritual as its foundation rather than material. This is probably a big deal for, I would say, most people to try to find a philosophy that fits who they are. You might want to check out Rand's philosophy, which some people call objectivism, but it's not really that. It's more metaphysics, but he just invented that word. It seemed pretty good to sell. And you might want to also check out metaphysics in general. Why? Because it lends itself to understanding the philosophy of life instead of understanding life as bits and pieces of, we'll say, catchphrases and wrongful illusions, ideas that seem on the surface to be good but are terribly destructive and evil. It also allows us to do something that Rand points out pretty well, to see evil. You see, if you don't understand and see evil, you may support it and not even understand that. And the ability to see evil is very critical on Earth right now because we're being tested. It's a terrible test in a sense. But without the right philosophy, I don't know that people are ever going to be able to get out of this. Because the right philosophy allows us to realize that evil, first of all, is a choice by people. Only people become evil. And it's a choice that can be changed, but it can't be changed by placating it, which is a big deal, or by participating with it in any other way besides placation, or by or pretending it doesn't exist, or not seeing that it exists, or not allowing other people to see it exists when you have the opportunity to do so. These are critical things, and Earth is in a test right now, this planet, because we're trying to overcome a very special kind of evil that's more mental than just astral. Most places where evil exists, which is a lot of places, it's just astral, and that isn't so dangerous. But once it starts becoming monastic or mental, it takes another dimension of time and space to do that, and it becomes very, very dangerous, and a true threat to life itself and to, therefore, God's growth. And it's very anti-God, of course. So having the right philosophy and understanding what that means and being able to expose evil to yourself and others is a big deal. And it involves leading a life that is more spiritual and material, because evil uses materiality as a control mechanism for its gaining its own power over others. If you're not material, evil's not going to be able to get any power over you. They may be able to do other things. You may not be able to see it right, because there's other things besides just that in terms of seeing evil. But that's the first thing that will not have power over you. The important element is, if you don't want to participate or placate in anything, then you have to go more than just a question of not leading a material life over spiritual. But you also have to be able to use power yourself and in ways that still involves material issues, and so that you don't become evil yourself, but you are able to expose evil and even fight it in some circumstances, especially in the mental aspects of it. And you don't have to go out and shoot people. You may have to use mental bolts. You may have to use a lot of mental kind of forces that you'll be involved with. And that's part of the situation. It's a responsibility everybody has, but few people take. Now, can you make a difference just by changing your philosophy? Yes. Believe it or not, yes. That's why I recommend this particular work by Ayn Rand, because she deals with all these issues, so it's worth reading. It's a huge book. 1,000 pages, something like that. Go see the movie, and then you can read 2/3 of the book, and you got the whole thing done. And so it really is, it gives you a potent weapon. Philosophy is different than just leading a spiritual life. Your philosophy of life needs to be integrous to how you're living your life. And it has to be integrous with your purpose in life. But you need to have a philosophy that works for you. And there's a lot of good ones. If you read Lights and Meaning, the textbook I wrote, you'll find that in there is presented underlying, but never as a quoted subject, a philosophy of life. Now, the philosophy of life in Lights and Meaning is a little more complete, maybe, than something you might need in Ayn Rand. And it's much more difficult to completely understand, because it deals with a thing called ontology and cosmology. Ontology is the ways in which God creates the universe, and cosmology is the universe that we observe and how it is seemingly fitting in to maybe the ontology. And if you can understand those things, then you can adopt a philosophy which is much richer and more complete, because it has many, many more elements to it that allows you to have, we'll say, weapons of use against the problems in the world today. And you can see evil when it's there, and you can do something about it more quickly and more effectively. But you've got to be willing also to make sacrifices and be willing to get beat up pretty bad sometimes, because you won't always win every fight that you have. And some of them can be pretty nasty. But nonetheless, philosophy is a big, it's a big part of the issue of spiritual versus material purpose. Once you get the right philosophy, it's easier to stay on track. So that's something to consider. Most people don't know or don't have a philosophy that they live by. It's worthwhile to consider some of them and to look at the differences. Ones that I don't appreciate are some of the existential philosophies. Why not? Because some of the existential philosophies are nihilistic in their thought process. They deny both the existence of God, because they say that things are too random to be godly, and in some cases. And they also concern themselves wrongfully with a more negative outcome in terms of human existence. So they see humans as victims of a universe that has not much kindness towards you. Now, that's not all existential philosophies, but some of them do. What other kinds of philosophies am I not too fond of? around it. Logical positivism, what is that? That's the belief that only tangible material things exist, and the rest of the world is some kind of fantasy we create for ourselves, so it's more comfortable for us to live within our own consciousness because we fear death so much in other reasons. That isn't true. It's a fake philosophy. It's a true mistaken philosophy based upon illusion. But it is what a lot of people believe in, particularly if they're strongly influenced by the material side of life and science put together. Not because they're interested only in science, but because they see the world as an outcome of material events only. They don't see a spiritual side of existence. So they become many times logical positivists. So those kinds of philosophies are kind of a negative, not too good of a place to come from. And the most important element to any philosophy is that there be a spiritual element to it. If there's no spiritual element, then you can almost for sure just leave that alone. It's not going to probably get you anywhere because you're eliminating the very reason there is life, in my opinion. Life is God's growth, at least part of God's growth is life. So it's a pretty big deal, huge deal as far as I'm concerned. Okay, so another practical thing to look at the time here. I'll get to some of the little things. Okay, let's talk about some of the little practical things. Spiritual versus material purpose in life. If you're looking for a mate, someone to be close with and share, I'm talking about friendship close level, but also sexual level. The important element here is to recognize that sexuality is part, in terms of human beings, is part of God's plan to help us to experience something outside of ourselves that is a direct experience. Part of that is in the sexuality and through the love that may be expressed in both. And it allows us to, for the first time, maybe, to experience something beyond ourselves directly besides God, as in the, we'll say, as a conceptual being, but not as an interactional sense. So it's very important that human beings consider this as part of their life as a spiritual purpose. And there, the sexuality needs to be much more weighted towards spiritual involvement than material, but you do need to feel sexual with the person. You do need to exchange energy, which is material, with the person if it's going to be sexual. I know some people say, well, I want all my sexuality to be purely ethereal, touching, or whatever. That's cool if that's what you want to try, but that's not going to be real sex. Real sex does involve actual exchange of energy, even in the astral and the mental worlds, where there's no physical energy, but there's energy of those worlds. You still have sexuality. So the sexuality allows you to become something beyond just yourself because you're experiencing the other person, particularly by giving them energy that is in their intensity and phase. It allows you to experience what they're like and vice versa, but only through love, through giving in a way that's wise, that helps them to become more who they are, does it serve its purpose. So this is a big part of being human, and for most people it's an important part. The element here is to try to find somebody that you can do this with. It's self-defining. Now, most people don't understand what I'm saying when I say it that way, so I'll try to be more clear. The only person you're going to be able to be spiritual in sexuality with is a person you are in love with, and it's going to be a person, not a people. It's not going to be plural. Monogamy is required if you're going to be spiritually, sexually involved with someone. Now, you can have all the sex you want, so 10 people, 100 people, but you're going to only be able to have spiritual sex if you're involved with one person at a time, at least. When I mean at a time, I don't mean every 5 minutes. I mean one person at a time in your life, okay? Not like, well, this week I'm involved with this person, next week I'm involved. No, I'm not talking about that. That's polygamy stuff. I'm talking about monogamy. got to be monogamous. And the sexuality therefore, you learn by the experience of the sexuality how to give to that other person and vice versa. And it's very complicated. It's quite difficult to do. And it is not always successful, even with people who are good at it together. It's not always successful. So without a question, if you start involving a whole bunch of other people, you're just going to louse it up to the person that you're with, you know, in a monogamous sense, and it's all going to all go southward. And this is a big deal for most people because they really do seek a close relationship, but they don't understand the sexual issues involved, and they may not understand that this is a spiritual versus material purpose and life issue. So they don't get all that. They just know, gee, I really like to be with someone, and I want to be with someone who loves me, and I love them, and then I really like to have sex with them. Yeah, all those things go together, but they are much more involved interactively than you may care to take responsibility for, and it is a huge responsibility and a lot of work. It is not easy to do. Why not? Because personality gets in the way, and this is a soul issue. You can't be spiritual with another person except on a soul level. Personalities cannot do it together alone. So if you try to have a personal relationship only with someone that does not have a soul-level content to it, you will never be able to achieve the real loving nature. And you'll be robbing yourself and them of the true nature of spiritually, sexually, of love. And consequently, the purpose in life will be reduced rather than gained, and your consciousness will not grow from it. If at best will stay the same, and more likely will shrink. So the negative side of sexual relationships with human beings is that when they don't reach these high levels that I'm talking about, they oftentimes have more negative than positive consequences for the people involved. It doesn't mean you shouldn't try it. I'm not saying, well, just because it isn't going to be a true loving whatever, you shouldn't have sex. I'm not going to say that. Because there's a lot of practice that sometimes is needed, even in failure, before you find the right person and understand what that means. So sometimes being with the wrong person or wrong people for some time is a maturing process that may, for some people, be necessary. So the idea that, well, gee, I'm going to be totally celibate until I find the perfect person may not be the right answer. And I know that's totally against some people's religious beliefs. And so I'm stepping on their toes now. But the point is that it's really true that, unfortunately, human beings don't have a built-in barometer, particularly when it comes to sex, about when they really are in a loving relationship sexually with a person or when they're just feeling a lot of sex and they don't know the difference. And sometimes that takes experience to really find out, especially among younger old people, people who haven't had a huge number of incarnations. It might be totally necessary for them to experience sexuality in a number of different ways before they can, so to speak, understand it enough to move in the right direction. Now, that may sound terrible to people who believe that they're not going to have sexual relations except with the one person they're going to marry, who's going to be the person with them for life, and they can do this because they both believe in the same God, and that God's going to help them. Maybe it will. I don't know. I can't say. If you really have enough of other spiritual foundations, sexuality may work for you under that basis. But that's going to take a huge amount, in my opinion, of real spiritual discipline. If you've got it, it might work. But if you're living it because your parents think that way or your friends think that way, and that's the only reason you're living that way, I don't think it will work for you. Because then you're getting to that philosophy issue. And your spiritual versus material purpose in life is going to be totally upside down, and it's not going to work. You're going to have all the problems that are inherent with a personality-driven issue. Because you're doing it for the wrong reason. You see, you're doing it because you want to look like you're being blank, blank religious, rather than because there is a true spiritual meaning behind it in yourself in that life. I know, it's complicated, isn't it? It's really complicated. Okay, let's talk about another one real quick. One of the biggies that a lot of people seem totally into these days is, quote-unquote, certain hobbies or avocational things outside of spiritual avocation. And you think that's a big deal in terms of their spiritual versus material life. They think their hobby is, in some ways, a spiritual issue. Might be. Here's the thing. If you have a hobby that in some way you are enlightening yourself through and that you can share and help others to do the same with, great. Fantastic. Then it's, to me, that's perfect. But if the hobby is something that allows you to feel a sense of control only, and that is more personality-driven in the sense that it substitutes for real meaning in life, which is some people's hobbies do that, then, unfortunately, moving in the wrong direction. You may also increase your loneliness from the process, because instead of helping other people become more spiritually aware and driven and enlightened, you, even though you might be sharing your hobby with them, maybe you even do it over the internet or you get together or however, the interesting thing is that you're doing it in ways that are still so personality driven that you don't have the, we'll say, you have it upside down again. You don't have the right spiritual versus material purpose in it. And so your consciousness will suffer from the hobby. And some people have that happen. And then they find themselves empty. They have the hobby, they spend 10 years doing it, whatever, and all these people are involved with. And then they feel very disillusioned. If you find yourself even the slightest about going in that direction, reassess what you're doing and make sure that the hobby has real spiritual meaning in it. Or find yourself something different to do. Or find yourself in a way to become more spiritual within what you already are doing. It's your choice. And you can make that choice to make the difference in your life. I hope today's show has really helped you to see some practical side to this issue of spirituality versus materiality. And it's like I said, I was trying to get at the ways that people have conflicts in these areas and how they can make themselves into a, hopefully, a more meaningful life that is more soul-driven. Because you remember, the more you become your soul, the more you become the great immortal being that you came from and you're going back to. It's just in a temporary basis that you're not that soul. And this is the time to wake up to try and be it while you're here, because you can create so many good things in the most difficult place to do it, here in the physical world. Okay, well, we're running out of time. You know that thing that I said we should have as much as we like? Well, I try to do what I can, but one of the things is that I haven't found a way to make more time in terms of the radio show, except I speak faster and I just go over a bunch of stuff. So I hope this show has made a difference for you. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.
Hi, this is Llewellyn, and you can hear my music on BBS Radio. Check out the Paradise Music storefront, where you can hear samples of many of my albums and other Paradise Music albums. BBS Radio, the number one live internet talk radio network on the planet.